You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Bottled water is a $300 billion global industry and the most consumed packaged drink worldwide. For many Americans, bottled water has become part of our everyday lives. But that's a pretty recent trend that has grown over the past few decades. Not that long ago, it was a punchline.
Drink the bottled water. I feel silly buying it, though. Maybe I'm just too Midwestern, you know. It's like, whenever I go in a store, I'm always like, hey, how you doing? Yeah, I know I can get water free from any faucet, but I want to pay for it. I'm just curious, do you have any air back there? Or can I buy your garbage? When you think about it, it is water, right? How did we get to the point where we're paying for bottled water? That must have been some weird marketing meeting over in France, you know? Let's just tell the Americans the water's from France. We bought it.
That's comedian Jim Gaffigan doing a stand-up routine back in 2000. So why now do so many Americans spend billions of dollars each year on bottled water? In a new book, our next guest digs into that question and says that bottled water is part of a deeper story of the environment, inequality, and the commodification of a public service. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you drink tap or bottled water at home? Do you buy bottled water when you're dining out or traveling? Have you switched over to carrying a reusable bottle? And were you part of the story a couple decades back when Perrier looked to bottle water here in Wisconsin? Big, long controversy there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Jaffe is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University, where he researches the social, environmental, and economic impacts of bottled and packaged water. His new book is called Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
Before we dig into the story behind bottled water, I don't know if people really realize the scope and the change that's happened. I remember when, you know, it was kind of like a joke where, so, oh, you've got a glass bottle of Perrier. Ooh, fancy. And now it's this dominant product. Can you talk about the rapid rise?
Sure. Well, I start the book with a story of saying I confess that I'm old enough to remember a time when I was in grade school in the 1980s when, single serve plastic bottled water was really not a product that anybody had thought of yet. Mm-hmm. 1980, Americans consumed just 2 gallons per person per year on average. And it was pretty much, as the comedian said, Perrier in heavy glass bottles, thought of as kind of an odd product. And somehow we got from that to just over 40 years later, Americans consuming 47 plus gallons per person per year on average, 90% almost of Americans consuming some bottled water, and really surprisingly, 1 in 5 Americans refusing the tap entirely when it comes to drinking water and getting all of their drinking water from packaged bottles. And so in researching this book, I was looking into that riddle of how we got there. And I found, just, you know, to sort of preview, that bottled water turns out to not just be kind of a controversial product, which also has a lot of negative environmental impacts that many might be familiar with. But it turns out, and I was surprised to find how deeply connected it is to the social injustice and inequality crisis of uneven access to safe and affordable water, both here in the U.S. And around the world.
I wanted to dig into that big picture. This idea, this debate you set out almost at the beginning, is water a commodity that I can make money by selling in bottles or in other ways versus is water a public right or a public good that we should take the profit motive out of? Could you talk about how that conversation has changed over the last few decades?
Yeah. So beginning, you know, and the form in which many people are more familiar with that struggle over water should be primarily a human right or a commodity provided by the market, has first sort of came to people's mind and awareness in terms of struggles over whether the provision of public tap water should be privatized in places around the world, from Bolivia to Indonesia to cities here in the U.S. Private water companies began taking over the provision of drinking water, and there were a lot of opposition movements that formed in response, private companies taking over an essential service, and water rates would tend to rise, and there were contentions around the quality of the service, and a lot of backlash. And it turns out that while there was a big push for private tap water provision, there is a counter movement, a strong kind of a counter wind. The remunicipalization of many of those systems has taken place. They've come back into public hands. But I think what's gotten less attention is this other major form of what some would call the privatization of drinking water, which is the rise of bottled and packaged water in different forms around the world. And its sort of growth into a global industry, as you say, passing $300 billion. And I think that, it turns out, to generate its own kind of opposition movements. There's been less attention to it, but I think that it is set to very quickly become the largest, the fastest growing, and the most significant form of the privatization or the, as you say, the commodification of drinking water.
One big development that's turned out to be one of the big problems in bottled water is lightweight plastic. Can you talk about this technological development that really made it so relatively cheap to ship lots and lots of little bottles of water?
Yes, it turns out that the industry was experimenting with plastic water bottles as far back as 1969, actually. But it wasn't until the early 90s that they sort of cracked the code of making this lightweight PET plastic easily producible and sell. You know, so the conversion to PET plastic, that number one plastic lightweight bottles, began. And I think if you remember back to the 90s, those who were around, suddenly it seemed like everything was being sold in plastic instead of glass. And PET really was the development, the technological development, that allowed the industry to mass produce this product. And production and consumption grew very rapidly. And then bottled water became very big business, and the big food and beverage companies got involved. And so, not coincidentally, in the 90s, when was also when you saw the big soda makers, Pepsi and Coke, get into the business with Dasani and Aquafina, and they and Nestle and Danone began buying up smaller bottlers around the country and around the world. And those four firms, the big four, I call them, have led the market both here at home and around the world ever since.
Talking to Daniel Jaffe about his new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. Daniel, one big point here. With the early days of bottled water, it was like, oh, this is fancy stuff from a spring, you know, artesian wells, whatever. That's not mostly what we're drinking in the United States. Where is our water? When we buy that bottle of water, where is it usually coming from?
Right. So the packaging portrays usually pristine springs or lakes and a snow-clad mountain in the background. But in reality, over the last few decades, the makeup of bottled water has shifted to the point where in the U.S. now, only just a little over a third of bottled water comes from groundwater at all, springs or any other form. And almost two-thirds, something like 63% of bottled water sold on the shelves is taken simply from municipal water systems, from the city water systems in different communities. It is taken out, refiltered. The companies strip out the mineral content, and then they add their own sort of proprietary mineral mixes, which, you know, give it their trademark taste, so that, you know, for example, Dasani would taste the same in Wisconsin as it would in New York State and California, which I think, incidentally, has probably contributed to training people's palates and maybe is one of the reasons why some people express dissatisfaction with the taste of their tap water. But so, yes, the vast majority of bottled water in the U.S. now is coming actually simply from public tap systems, but it is, of course, being sold for either hundreds to thousands of times the cost. And I will add that on top of the cost difference, the environmental impact is quite significant. One study calculated that bottled water's energy impact is about 1,000 to 2,000 times higher per gallon than providing tap water. And then the overall environmental impact, counting all different factors, is somewhere between, newer study, somewhere between 1,400 and 3,500 times higher. So it is a product with a very big ecological footprint, and that's not even to mention the plastic waste crisis on a global level.
Let's mention that plastic issue now. I think we might think, okay, I buy that plastic bottle, I drink it, I drop it in the bin, gets recycled, it'll show up in the next bottle of water. Mm. You did find it in water on the shores, I think in Thailand, Daniel, that this is a big plastic problem, these single-use bottles.
Yeah, I mean, that was my first exposure to this, really, this global disaster, I think, the ecological disaster of single-use plastic pollution, just in a place where the shore off of an island was coated in a floating mass of plastic, mostly bottles, but other garbage as well, for several hundred feet out. But it turns out that globally, people are consuming between 600 and 700 billion single-use plastic bottles of all beverages. But because bottled water is by far the top selling packaged beverage around the world, it contributes the largest share to that marine waste problem. And one study found that bottles and their caps, the beverage bottles and their caps, are the number one marine garbage item. Another study found that they accounted for almost 50% of all marine waste. So dealing with the global single-use plastics issue really requires dealing with the problem of single-use beverages, but also particularly packaged water. And the U.S. recycling rate is actually quite low for these bottles. It's gone down over the years. It's down to about 26% of bottles were recycled. Most of those do not get turned into new bottles. Only something like 7 to 10% do. The rest are sort of what's called downcycled. They become, you know, carpets or whatever, less high-quality products. And around the world, the bottle recycling rate is much lower. It's something like 7 to 9%.
Talking to Daniel Jaffe about his new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you avoid plastic water bottles? What led you to do that, if so? Or are they more convenient? Do you maybe trust it more than the tap water at your home or place of work? What questions do you have about the rise of this bottled water industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Daniel Jaffe about the bottled water industry and his new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. More often than not, I get my water in glass bottles, spring water. I want to confirm that when it says spring water, is that in fact spring water and not purified?
Christina, thanks for the call. Daniel, you write in the book that regulations, especially if water doesn't cross state lines, are non-existent or vague at best?
Right. Well, about the question of spring water labeling, the FDA, so bottled water, it's worth noting, is treated as a foodstuff, and it's regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. The FDA does have specific regulations about what can be called spring water. It's fairly liberal. It can involve getting groundwater in many different ways. Whether companies are abiding by those regulations, I have no way of knowing, but there is at least a legal definition that they have to be held to. But in contrast to FDA regulation of bottled water, The regulation of tap water systems, our public tap water, is falls under the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And, you know, it's worth noting that the difference between those two, I sort of say, is effectively the difference between night and day. There's a pretty dramatically uneven playing field between the bottled water industry and public tap water providers in terms of the regulatory structures they're under, not so much in terms of the contaminants that they're allowed to have. They're held to roughly the same maximum levels of contaminants. But EPA regulation is far more rigorous. Tap water utilities have to test their water more often and have to critically report to the public when they find contamination almost immediately, and also publish annual reports. Whereas bottled water companies, the concern is that they test the water themselves. The FDA does inspect plants, but it has a diminishing number of inspectors. And there's been some interesting reporting on this by Consumer Reports and other outlets looking at the weakness of the bottled water regulatory regime. Overall, it's very, very unlikely that consumers will find out if and when the bottled water they're consuming has contamination found. On top of that, I'll just add one more thing around bottled water safety, which is that peer-reviewed academic studies have found recently that bottled water contains higher levels of microplastic fragments. And one academic study found that somebody consuming only bottled water would consume 22 times more microplastic fragments than someone who consumed only tap water. So there is a difference in the regulation and in what the, and what they contain.
Christina, thanks for the call. Mike joins us now in Hudson. Mike, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, two things to note. I guess one, I've always had a strong preference of things out of a glass versus plastic. So I've not ever been an adopter of the plastic bottle consumer part. But the other question I have is how much of an impact are these water refilling stations having? I just traveled abroad to the UK and Ireland, and I was surprised to not see very many of them.
Mike, thanks for the call. Daniel, you write about this in the book. These have sprung up at a lot of places. Have these water refilling stations changed sales of bottled water?
So I'm going to assume that the caller is talking about refilling points, water refilling points like water fountains. In other words, getting your tap water out of a water refiller. In that case, so that is it's really happening in a lot of the wealthy nations and spreading around the world. The sort of the increasing what I call the reclaiming the tap segment of the movements responding to bottled water's growth, and that is a really fascinating kind of constellation of efforts that have happened between city governments, nonprofit organizations, universities, other public and private institutions, the last decade or more to sort of turn back to tap water. Cities saying, hey, you know, we are the providers of this tap water and we know it's really clean. And what does it make any sense for us to be purchasing bottled water for our city government offices or allowing it to be sold, say, on city property and public parks? And a growing number of cities, large ones from San Francisco to LA to New York and others, but a lot of small communities, counties around the country, and really around, you know, U.S., Canada, Europe, and beyond, are starting to enact bans on purchasing or selling bottled water on city property. And then the flip side, that sort of required two-step dance that they do if they ban it in some places, is to then expand access to clean of public tap water, free public tap water in public places. And I think that's one of the most interesting and dynamic parts of what's going on is these communities are rolling out shiny new, hundreds of shiny new hydration stations, public water fountains, refill points, and then private businesses are getting in on the act. There are networks where businesses have stickers in their windows. There are apps. One big app is called the Refill app. It comes from a nonprofit group based in the UK, but it now has, it's gone global. It has 300,000 refilling points on its app. So you can like look to find out what the nearest place you can get a free refill. Sometimes it's in a coffee shop that won't make you buy anything. They'll just give you free water. And that's sort of taking off as a movement. And it has actually gotten the attention of the bottled water industry, and they are concerned. I do a lot of reading of market literature and market reports, and the industry is concerned. And they say, particularly young folks, but across the board, people turning back to the tap is making a dent in sales. I just looked at the latest statistics last week in the U.S. For the first time since the Great Recession, bottled water consumption actually fell by one report, by 1%. And that's new. And I think at least some of that change owes to these movements that are taking interest in reclaiming the tap. I quote one representative from a bottled water company who told a conference, quote, the water bottle has in some ways become the mink coat or the pack of cigarettes. It's socially not very acceptable to the young folks, and that scares me, unquote. So the industry is alert to this, and they are concerned.
Mike, thanks for the call. Daniel, in our last couple minutes, another part of the story I want to get into. You looked at the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and some other places. Some of the bottled water marketing material, internal material you mentioned, talks about, hey, this is maybe a growth opportunity if people don't trust their water. And you worry that that's going to lead maybe to lack of trust in municipal water and disinvestment in public water supplies. Can you take our last couple of minutes and talk about that?
Yeah, that's very important. So a counter trend to what I just described, this sort of turning back to the tap among people in communities that have the privilege of, you know, high quality tap water, which is the vast majority of U.S. drinking water utilities, by the way. But a small percentage, very small, 7-8% at the absolute most of U.S. water systems do have water quality health related violation within any given year. And those problems are not evenly distributed. They tend to fall disproportionately in certain kinds of communities, low income communities, rural communities, and overwhelmingly communities predominantly populations of people of color, African Americans and Latinos in particular. And those, it turns out, are the social groups who also distrust their tap water the most, and who have turned to buying bottled and packaged water the most. And the industry is aware of this. And so what we actually now have, I think, is, and rather than sort of say people are misinterpreting, because obviously if 20% of people are not drinking tap water, but it's only, you know, 7% or 8% of the systems have a violation, some people are turning away from perfectly good water. But rather than say there's a misperception, I think we could see that as a logical reading of the uneven distribution of risks. And so I argue that, you know, when we have, I think that bottled water is in these communities is serving to increase economic and racial inequalities sort of between the clean water haves and have-nots. And I think we're only going to really be able to resolve this distrust problem and the deterioration problem from underfunding of public water systems by restoring that federal role. The federal government used to fund it at a much higher level, going back to strong federal funding that will bring up the quality and restore the quality of water systems across the board so that everyone will view tap water once again as trustworthy.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Daniel Jaffe, Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University. We've been talking about his latest book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, stream live, or check out or share archived copies of conversations here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Women make up about 35% of all the agricultural producers in Wisconsin. That's 5% higher than the national average. That's according to the 2017 Census of Agriculture. A project here in Wisconsin has been bringing together multiple groups to work with women to promote conservation and land stewardship. They celebrate a number of Wisconsin women in conservation in a new publication out this month called Portraits of Love on the Land. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you own, farm, or otherwise look after a patch of land in Wisconsin? What kind of practices do you have in place around conservation, big or small? Do you have questions about opportunities to promote different kinds of conservation on a small patch of land, big patch of land, any point in between? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Esther Durayraj is Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation. She's a research agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. Esther, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Laura Langworthy is Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and an owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler. Lauren, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Esther, you've been celebrating a year of programming this year, including with this new publication I mentioned. Can you tell us what the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project is all about?
So thanks for asking me that question. Wisconsin Women in Conservation is a program that's funded by the Natural Resources Conservation Service and led by the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, which is based out of East Troy, Wisconsin. We partner with other nonprofits, as you mentioned, in Wisconsin, namely Renewing the Countryside, Wisconsin Farmers Union, and Marble Seed. And we work with women landowners, farmers, in order to bring education, outreach about conservation practices. And not only that, we bring resources, trying to bring in the finance, because women have a lot of questions on their mind. But they are good stewards. As we know, women are nurturers by nature of their families, of their land. And so when they want to be better stewards of the land, they have this, like, a lot of questions about how to go about it. And is that even financially possible? So we try to be the intermediary, bringing people who are connecting women with women. We also bring NRCS resources to them and see how they can make their dreams possible for the land.
And Esther, looking at Portraits of Love on the Land, conservation and stewardship means a lot of different things. Can you talk about a little bit about the range of the projects that participants are doing on their own land?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this has been an enjoyable experience for us to bring out this book. So women are involved in grazing lands, in agriculture, in urban farming, wetland preservation, soil health, waterways. There's a lot of things that women have been working on to be better stewards of the land. And so as we work with these women, we want to kind of bring out their voices about what they have been doing. If you look at, like, many a times when we Google this, like, conservation, not many of those women pop up. So we want to change that landscape, because women are doing a lot of things, and we want to bring those stories to their forefront. And so this book has brought about all that, so many of their stories, and we thank those women who have shared their stories with us and to be open about it, to bring it to the public domain.
Lauren, let's visit Blue Ox Farm. Now, it sounds like when you and your partner started this off, you really did have conservation and stewardship in mind right at the outset. Can you talk a little bit about that mindset, first of all?
Absolutely. Well, when we started our farm, my husband, Caleb, it had really spent a lot of time aspiring to be a farmer and learning a lot about agriculture. And I was more of a nature kid who really enjoyed the outdoors and could picture myself living on a farm and all the wonderful things that could come with it, but certainly had a lot more to learn on the agricultural front. And since then, you know, our big adventure has been trying to figure out how to merge both of those visions and try and make our farm both a place that produces food and supports our community, but also has wild space for, you know, the badgers and the foxes and the grassland birds that are endangered. And so trying to balance kind of the economic piece and the personal livelihood, and then these larger goals for what our community and our landscape should look like. It's definitely a challenge, but it's a fun challenge.
And your farm, what you actually produce there, has evolved over the years. I read in the book here, and you've gone into grass-based animal production now, kind of as your main gig. Could you talk a little bit about how you do that with conservation and stewardship in mind?
Absolutely. Yeah. When we first started, we started with vegetable production, and we kind of joke that it's a good way to turn sweat into money. Doesn't take a lot of infrastructure to get going in vegetables, but it does take an awful lot of work. And as we were doing annual tillage and running a CSA and wholesale accounts and selling at farmers markets and into food co-ops, we were just feeling like we were spending a lot of time tilling soil and weeding. There was a lot of bare soil, even with the best production model that we were able to kind of muster. And I know some people who are able to do it much better than we were, but we were looking at ourselves and thinking, why can't we get more perennials into this system? And why can't we get more things covered and have less bare soil, less tillage? And so that really led us on some self-reflection and some business model reconsideration. And that's how we kind of ended up in livestock, specifically rotational grazing. And so that rotational grazing allows us to really provide some good habitat, do soil building and microbe building, create a healthy animal, and also kind of manage our own labor a little bit better.
We're talking about Wisconsin Women in Conservation. Lauren Langworthy is with us, owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler, and Esther Dreiraj, Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation, also with the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a conservation or land stewardship project going on in your backyard, in your 40 acres, whatever land you're working with? Is there something you've been doing to maintain the soil, maintain animal and plant species and more. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Esther, for that new farmer, maybe a woman getting into farming for the first time or after growing up and then returning to a farm, what kind of help is out there for them here in Wisconsin? What kind of community and mentorship can they reach out for?
Okay. So the way we do our program is to have these for learning circle events. So when they do come into one of these events, they sit with a sister community of women farmers and landowners who are sharing their stories about how they started and how they built their farm, or if the new beginning farmer has questions, they are able to help them. And we also bring in the FSA and the NRCS resource persons. So they are able to right away tell them what are the resources that's available for them for purchase of land or for building infrastructure or for all these conservation practices that they can do. And so they go back with a kind of a knowledge of what's available, what's existing. We also have conservation coaches. Lauren is one of our coaches here, who will be able to tell them what are the different things that, like, as she just mentioned, how she thought about a business plan and moved her farm along. These are the kind of stories that the women are exposed to, and they learn from each other. So this is basically a peer-to-peer model, and we kind of find motivation in each other and help the women grow in as a beginning farmer.
And Lauren, I'm looking at a picture of you educating in the book right now. I think, why was it important for you not just to try to make your farm operation a success, but to share lessons you learned along the way with others?
That's a great question. You know, as farmers, we are so busy. We have to have so many different types of skills, from business management to all the technical skills of livestock or plant management and health. And there's just so much that you need to learn. And it's really hard to start from zero in all of those arenas and become an expert in the time that we have. And you really only have one opportunity a season for most agricultural knowledge to be utilized, and then you have to wait until the next year to try it again. So I think any time that we can support each other by sharing the knowledge we've learned, especially about things that can be really complex, like how to navigate some of these government program opportunities or how different ecosystems function, it really helps us all get further when we can share that knowledge into a general pot as opposed to hold on to it all ourselves.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project and how it's helping women landowners and other women stewards of land in Wisconsin. Our guests are Esther Durayraj, Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation and Research Agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, and Lauren Langworthy, Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and an owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler. A new publication out called Portraits of Love on the Land tells the story of a lot of these women getting involved in farmland conservation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation. Are you doing some kind of conservation project on land you own, or on, are you working maybe as a volunteer on public land? Love to hear your story. Or do you have questions for our guests about what it means to do land stewardship and conservation here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about Wisconsin Women in Conservation. Esther Durayraj is Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation and a Research Agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And Lauren Langworthy is Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler, featured in the new publication Portraits of Love on the Land. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer yourself on a large or small scale, what kinds of conservation things do you do? What kind of stewardship do you do for your soil and land? And wherever you are, whatever you do you try to plant maybe native species to help butterflies and other animal and insect species? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Esther, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this isn't one size fits all. A lot of different people do different conservation projects. How could people figure out, okay, this is the land I've got, this is the agriculture maybe I'm doing, what kind of conservation methods might be right for me?
So when the women or landowners or farmers come to one of our events and express interest in having a conservation plan, then we right away work with them. We just have something called an intake form where we get the information about their land, their practices that they are adopting as of now, and what they want to see on their land. Sometimes women straight away want to go in for cost share programs, which is the EQIP through NRCS, and then we connect them to the NRCS, and the NRCS professionals walk their land and tell them what is possible for them. And sometimes women are not ready to go there. They just want to know what can they do, what are the possibilities, what are the limitations. And in that case, then we have the funding to have a technical service provider walk their land. We make those arrangements. We find the people to walk the land, give them, talk with them, talk about the dreams that they have for the land. Like, they may have certain dreams that can be possible or not. So this person who walks their land is able to tell them, who's a conservation professional, who's able to tell them what works, what may not, what's the other options that they have. And then at the end of it, they would get a conservation plan document, which they can have it, think about it, and then go for the next step as soon as possible or as late as possible. It depends on them. But they at least have a knowledge of what can be done on their land.
And Lauren, you give a top conservation tip in the Porches of Love on the Land book. You start saying, start small. Make the case for being willing to start small, even if it doesn't seem like it's going to be a big difference maker.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a joke to those people who know me, but I'm not notorious for starting small or keeping things small. But it's actually really helpful, especially when you're looking at significant changes to a farming operation, to change, you know, a couple of smaller things and see if you like the direction it's going and give it some time to take hold, because conservation really isn't something that happens overnight. And a small change could take years, maybe even, to really reflect on the land. And so being gentle and patient with yourself and not feeling like you have to do it all at once or you have to do really, really big things when you're not entirely certain, it can actually help the whole process go a lot more smoothly to make it more manageable and more achievable.
Esther, I wanted to highlight one project in particular. Now, we might think of agricultural stewardship and conservation as something that happens in rural Wisconsin, which it does. You feature, though, a project in Milwaukee. Could you talk a little bit about that one?
Yeah, we have an urban ag network in Milwaukee as well, because, you know, actually for rural and urban settings, the agriculture is totally different sense. Many of the urban people are gardeners, community gardeners or backyard gardeners, and we didn't want them to be let out off the loop. So we have them as well. As a part of our group, we meet separately in Milwaukee. We talk with them. Is there any pollinator planting that they would like to have? Is there, something with the vegetable gardens that they're raising? How can we help them? How can we have their land covered during winters, maybe a cover crop? So these are the options that we talked to them. And we also brought out a rainfall simulator a couple of months ago for them to see, like, realistically what happens when a rainfall event happens on their land. And, you know, we bring such kind of education, which opens the eyes for them to adopt various conservation measures, even if it's in a smaller scale.
And Lauren, can you talk a little more? We've talked about why you got into wanting to share education about conservation. On a practical level, what does it mean to be a conservation coach?
Well, that's another great question. I think it really depends on the person who's seeking information. So our role is not as formal as, you know, when you go into the NRCS office or the FSA offices or anything like that. No government centers here. We're just farmers talking to other farmers about what might work and what might not. And so I'm able to share with people when I kind of hear what kinds of questions they have and what kind of hopes and dreams they have, I can say, oh, I happen to know about this program that could maybe provide some cost share toward that bigger goal you have. Or I know about an organization that's doing some work in that arena that could help you find some more resources. There are networks of other men and women that to get connected with. And so it's really trying to hear what a person is looking for and help them along their pathway to just not have to do it alone and not have to find everything from scratch.
Dr. Lauren Langworthy and Esther Dureraj about the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project and the new book from that project, Portraits of Love on the Land, featuring women doing all different kinds of stewardship and conservation. Esther, can you talk a little more about why focusing on women in particular? You were starting to touch on that earlier. Can you talk a little bit about the particular needs of women in conservation and stewardship?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. So the way we look at it, women are nurturers. We see that we take care of the family, we take care of relationships, we take care of the land. We are mostly the glue in every single thing that happens around us. And we see that women have great dreams for their land, but there are a lot of questions in the mind, like, is this workable? Is this financially feasible? And there are times that we find it difficult to ask those questions. And so when we bring a group of women together, we have seen this great bonding that happens within a period of an hour because we sit in a learning circle. We start out with introductions. We talk about what do you look forward to your land and what have you done on your land? We have different set of questions at different events. And so people start talking about the land. And we have like a seasoned landowner. We have beginning farmers people who are seeking the land who all are seeking for inspiration and motivation, and we learn from each other. It's a sense of togetherness, the sense of working together. So the way we feel is that, imagine if we can just bring about change in these number, 37% of women are producers now, and if we can bring about a change in how they steward the land in terms of conserving natural resources or bringing a big impact on the landscape, not only helps them, and the future generations and the kids are watching their moms. And that's a big change. And that's what is our passion. Our team drives on that passion. We really want to bring about this love for the land. And that's one of the book. That's the title of the book as well. How we really want women who are already loving the land, and we want to give them the opportunities to take better care of that.
Got an email from Patty in Lake Mills who writes, I farm 1,000 acres with our dairy farm. We have a nutrient management plan for our land. We soil sample the land after every crop to see what nutrients the land needs. Also, we plant cover crops like triticale and winter wheat to keep soil in place. And we rotate between corn, alfalfa, and soybeans. As a fellow livestock farmer, Lauren, can you talk a little bit about some of the other conservation options open for people raising animals?
Yeah, as with many conservation opportunities, it depends so much what your goals are and what your current infrastructure is. And so, you know, on my farm, we're doing rotational grazing, which means moving animals from paddock to paddock regularly. In our situation, it's pretty much every day they move to a new paddock. And that allows us to capture that manure and urea and put it back into the soil and grow more grass. But not everybody is set up to do that. Not everybody has either the land base to do it or the labor to do it. And so there are a lot of different ways that people can improve the conservation around their farm, anything from waterways to your caller mentioned planting cover crops to be able to capture some of that manure. There are just so many things. And depending on where you're starting from and where you're hoping to go, there are just so many opportunities for people.
Esther, in just our last minute or so, I understand the project has gotten an extension now for another couple of years. What are your hopes to accomplish over the next year or so?
Oh, we are moving into newer territories. We've been working in 18 tri-counties, in 18 counties, like 6 tri-county clusters over the last year. We're looking into moving into 12 more counties this year and the next. And so we really want more women to join us. At present, we almost have like last year alone, we reached out to about 1,000 women landowners who came to our programs and benefited from it. And we're looking to increase those numbers. We're looking to be of value to women landowners. And so I can just call out the names of the counties that we're going into next year: Trempealeau, La Crosse, Monroe, Dane, Rock, Jefferson, Green Lake, Columbia, Sauk, Eau Claire, Chippewa, and Clark. If you're a woman landowner, please connect with Wisconsin Women in Conservation at www.wiwic.org, www.wiwic.org.
We'll get that up at wpr.org/centraltime as well, and we'll leave it there. Esther, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
And Lauren, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Esther Dreiraj is Program Director for Wisconsin Women in Conservation and a research agronomist at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And Lauren Langworthy is Director of Special Projects for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and an owner of Blue Ox Farm in Wheeler. We talked to them today about the Wisconsin Women in Conservation Project, how it's been helping educate and provide resources to women farmers and other land stewards around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.